so that you remember what happened. Remember that what we did is we had used this ABM formalism. We got constraint equations. For the non-dynamical fields that we put in the action, the Lagrange multipliers, N and Ni. And we were working in this co-moving gauge. Where we weren't concerned with the field fluctuation, but instead the interesting stuff lived in the space part of the metric. And for this we had essentially the usual thing. A squared 1 plus 2 zeta delta ij, and then this thing we were calling gamma ij. And what we'd done is we'd expanded these things to first order in perturbation, solved for the result. So we found n was 1 plus, I forgot what we called it, n1 probably, something like that. And then we had the ni's, which were just there, started at first order, and we solve for this guy and for that guy. So I guess I could say this is zero if you like at lowest order. And we plugged back in and we got an equation of motion for zeta. Or if you like, we got the action, first we got the action at second order and the fluctuations for zeta. And we found that it looked very much like the usual thing, except with a normalization factor. And what we found was basically the only thing that was out in front. So there was an m-Planck squared, that zeta was dimensionless. There was a factor of 2 epsilon, which was important because it told us this thing vanished in the epsilon goes to zero limit. And then there was just the usual kinetic term. So it was a massless field. We put a root g here, which was an a cubed. And the only thing we had here was the kinetic term. So that was the g mu nu, g mu zeta term. Okay. So we said, since that looks essentially exactly like the equation that we've always had up to the normalization, if we assume that epsilon doesn't vary very much, then we just absorb this into the normalization, we do our usual thing, and out pops the power spectrum for the curvature. So we're calling this thing curvature zeta. And just so we have that result, what we got was that the dimensionless, so essentially the variance, the amplitude and fluctuations, power spectrum went like h squared over 8 pi squared epsilon m Planck squared. And the only trick is that quantities like this and this, since this is in momentum space, have to be evaluated at a particular k. And for each mode, the k that matters is the moment of horizon crossing. Okay. So a couple things that we didn't quite get around to pointing out. First of all, the equation of motion that we're going to get here is completely consistent with our idea that zeta is constant outside the horizon. So if we go back and actually evaluate the equation of motion for zeta, you can see that it's going to basically just have a kinetic part, which is going to give us a zeta double dot, and it's going to have some k squared zeta terms and some zeta dot terms. So the full thing, and I guess and also an epsilon dot if we cared about keeping epsilon dot, but let's not worry about that. Okay? So let's just assume that epsilon is more or less constant, and then the equation of motion has a zeta double dot term. In fact, it's essentially exactly what we expect, right? Zeta dot, these are all k's. The epsilon I'm going to drop. And the only piece, right, which we've been calling omega squared, looks like this. But in the limit where we're at super horizon scales, right, remember d by dt is basically of order h. It brings a contribution of order h. So we can do the thing before where, as long as we're in the regime, if this is h squared, the coefficient of zeta here is h squared, and this coefficient is k squared over a squared, then when we're in the very long length limit, so k is small compared to ah, we can drop this one. And then we have only time derivatives left, And so zeta k constant is certainly a solution. The other solution is exponentially decreasing. So so it's all consistent. Okay. So our whole story for zeta hangs together with the story that we had before, but we didn't have to choose this gauge, right? This was a choice that was simple because in this choice, that gauge invariant quantity that we kept evaluating just simply corresponded to the curvature, which just appeared in the metric, and that's the thing that was constant outside the horizon, so everything was very simple. We could have done something else. A different gauge, and one that's commonly used is called spatially flat, which again, we saw this motivated the other day, right? Because this basically just drops off the other part of the gauge invariant version of zeta, and it basically sets that psi equal to 0 and keeps delta phi. Okay, so if you like, you could go through this whole procedure and instead solve for delta phi. Same thing, exact same procedure. You go in, you solve the constraint equations, but now the solutions to the constraint equations, instead of being in terms of zeta and zeta dot, are going to be in terms of delta phi and delta phi dot. Okay, so sometimes that's a nice gauge to use because essentially you're always going to run into a problem here that this thing is sort of ill-defined when epsilon goes to 0 in some sense, or it's hard to know what happens in this limit. It's a little bit easier to take limits where delta phi becomes massless, and you go back to the Sitter case in the power spectrum for phi because it doesn't have this 1 over epsilon. And to remember that that 1 over epsilon comes from essentially doing a gauge transformation from this guy to this guy at horizon crossing. Okay, so now we would have had n was n of delta phi, et cetera. And again, you can substitute in. Again, you can solve. And you can get p of delta phi, p delta phi of k, as before. But the trick, then, is the trick that you've been doing on the homework and in the tutorial, is to do a change of gauge, essentially, at the horizon. And what you should have seen in a couple different ways by now is that what that looks like is basically just setting zeta equal to minus h over phi dot delta phi, phi 0 dot. And again, you can see that we can't do this if this thing is 0. So again, that same issue with this looking like it blows up in epsilon goes to 0 limit arises here because we're dividing by the velocity here. Okay. So you're allowed to do your calculation for phi up to horizon crossing, then phi isn't a very useful variable. Change gauge using this condition, and now just worry about the curvature from horizon crossing onward. And in some sense, outside of the horizon, things are basically classical, right? So all of the quantum work you can do with the field phi as before, and then you can essentially look at the classical evolution of this thing past that. Okay. Okay. Are there any questions about this idea from the homework and tutorial? It's okay. Okay, so the other thing we can get from this procedure is actually the gravitational part, right? So before, it was also relatively easy because we had this tensor mode that we saw had the same equation and a very simple equation as the scalar field. But now, when we wrote the whole action, we had the term, the curvature term, in the action to begin with, and so now we can just go back and expand that guy, and we'll get the action for the tensor fluctuation. So we can get it all with one go. And that's basically this gamma ij. So let me go back to the comoving gauge again and look at gamma ij. Not that it matters much for this. So we expect, so original action, before we did this ABM breakdown into the time and space, the original action had this R4 piece. And you expect that inside of R4 lives the kinetic term for this field, gamma ij, right? So this contains kinetic term for gamma ij. We split this guy up, though. We split it up into R3. And these EIJ terms stuff like that. I think there was n something, or n squared. I don't remember exactly. So we split it up into two different terms. And so now you have to go hunting a little bit for the full kinetic term, the time derivative and the spatial derivative of that piece. So basically, what we had for EIJ was, I think, HIJ. And then there were pieces like minus gradient I and J, and then the symmetric piece. So this has H dot. This has the kinetic piece, right? This has gamma IJ dot, the time derivative piece. And the spatial part still lives in here. But once you collect those, you find, again, a simple expression for the action for that gamma. And it looks exactly what you would expect. There has to be the kinetic, the time derivative, and the spatial derivative part. But the only thing that's a little bit surprising is the prefactor. And it's a factor of 8. Let me restore the M Planck. And again, put the root g, that's really the a cubed. And then what's left is just a gamma ij dot, gamma ij dot, and then the derivatives, which look like dl minus probably gamma ij dl gamma ij. Yeah, and there's an 8. So usually, whenever we have the metric that's in cosmological time, there's always a difference in the prefactor A that appears between these guys. Okay, so you can basically see again that essentially we're going to have the right equation for the components of this. But you can go to a little bit more work to actually break this up into the two variables that we called H plus and H cross on the tutorial. That are actually the real tensor modes, right? Because this thing has a bunch of constraints on it. It's not just any old two-dimensional or two-component term here. So on the tutorial or the homework, whichever it was, we made a particular choice, which actually I think was just on the board. So if you guys are in the GR class, you probably just saw a very related thing. But tutorial, we chose to imagine that we had momentum in the z direction, and then we wrote gamma ij as two terms, and I called them h before, but let me just call them gamma, gamma plus the x, and this has to be minus so that it's traceless, and it has to be symmetric, and these guys are all zero. And the fact that these guys are all zero is enforcing the condition, basically, that ki and ij is zero, the transverse condition. Okay. So there's two independent components here. But this isn't the most general expression, right? When we want to evaluate that guy, we really want to do a mode expansion for those zetas. And we want to do it in a generic way that doesn't rely on us choosing a particular direction for k or something like that. Okay. So the way that you classify these things, so to be more complete, let's say, to be complete, we want a more general expression. Or gamma ij for the modes, basically. Let me just call them gamma k. And you can see that there are really two of them, plus and cross here, something like that. Okay. Have you guys seen the general form of this matrix before? Because I think it was on the board when I came in. No, not really. No one nods immediately. You have? Yeah. So do you know how to classify this with rotations? No. Okay. Okay. So basically, if you think back to classifications related to angular momentum, we can classify this, gamma ij, by transformations under rotations. And you can, with this example where we've already taken a particular direction k, we can do a rotation around that k direction, which is the z direction here. So for this guy, we can, because we've written an example and we've chosen a direction for k, we can finish that example by looking at the rotation in that direction. So we want to look at specifically for this guy, a rotation about z. And so let's call that, we know there's a matrix RZ that does that rotation for us. And it's built of sines and cosines. Probably I get the sine wrong if I don't look. Cosine minus sine, sine, cosine, and zeros. Okay, so that's going to do a rotation for us around Z. And what we can look at is what happens to this matrix. So let's look at gamma when we basically act on it with this rotation matrix. How does it transform? Okay. So you can just work out what happens to each of these guys. And you'll find, after a little bit of algebra, that gamma plus goes to itself with cosine 2 theta, and it mixes with the gamma cross term as gamma cross sine 2 theta. And you can imagine that the other one does a very similar thing, except with a slight sign difference. So it goes to sine 2 theta here, and then minus, sorry, these should all be 2s. 2 theta is here. Yeah. I don't think so, do I? Let's see. Just so that because I have a cosine squared plus sine squared for the, sorry, you just want it here? Okay, yeah, sorry. Because then I have, yeah, okay, yeah, I think for this it doesn't matter because nothing is mixing with that component anyway, but yeah. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so you can see that there we can make a special combination of these guys as gamma plus or minus I gamma cross. And basically these things, since we're taking a particular combination where we have a cosine plus or minus I sine combination, we're going to just have an e to the I 2 theta that comes out. Plus or minus. Sorry, I think it's actually minus plus if we keep the sign convention the same as here. The same thing as before. So basically, that's sort of the standard definition of something that's helicity too. When you do a rotation by angle theta, it transforms by 2 times that angle. And so then what we can do to write the general expansion for these guys you want to write gamma in as a Fourier transform, and we wanted to write it for that full matrix gamma ij. So basically now we need sort of the projection operators, if you like, that pick out these combinations for us. So that's going to be, so that's going to be the sum over the two choices that we have. And then we call them plus minus for the choice of plus minus here. Over the guys that are the polarization tensors,
epsilon ij.
And so this is the thing that's actually going to do the choosing of whichever one it is I have of k hat. So these just depend on that rotation angle, the direction that we chose.
Gamma ijs.
So this is taking the general matrix and picking out for me the combinations that I want. And there are two of them.
So to finish the mode expansion, when we plug into the action for the field in real space, it's the usual v3k, 2 pi cubed, u the ikx.
But now we want this whole summation to live inside there. And it doesn't really matter now what this k is. I mean, we chose a z direction before, but now it doesn't really matter. It's all the same. Okay? So now we can plug this in. And what we're going to get are two equations for those particular components of gamma that we wanted. So we could have. So all this complicated stuff is doing is saying before what we did is we just made a simple choice that satisfied our conditions. We plugged that in and got the equation of motion. Now we've just written a more general version of how to make that choice that we plug into the equation of motion. It amounts to the same thing. We're still going to get essentially the same equation for each component, right? Okay. So you plug it in, and the canonical field. So basically, in each term there's two gammas that come together, right? So we're going to have two of these epsilons that come together. And depending on how we normalize those things, there's a factor of 2 in them. So, and there's also this 1 over 8 out in front. So one half of that is normal from the kinetic term, but that leaves a 1 quarter that's left over. So let's just absorb that 1 quarter into the field. So we want gamma ij hat is going to be m Planck over 2 gamma ij. Yeah.
Are you not sending over the ij on the right side of this equation?
That's right. So, yeah. So, well, okay, let's see. So, yeah, so I think, yeah, when I do, yeah, that's right. Those are just the individual terms. Because I want it. Yeah, so there I need to take each term. So when I plug this guy in, basically the way that the summation happens is going to be simpler because of the epsilon ij's. So when I have momentum dotted into this guy, it's going to simplify into the diagonal piece and things like that. So basically the rules for how momentum. No, sorry. Okay, if it's summed there, it has to be summed here if I'm plugging it in directly. So it's true that the sum is going to simplify a lot because of the rules for this epsilon ij. But yeah, if it's summed there, it has to be summed here. I think it's fine, right? Because actually then, you're saying it looks weird because what I wrote here is each component in terms of ij. Okay, let's imagine that it's each component here. So I think what's going to happen is there, if I'm also not summing, this is going to pick out for me only the components that I want. And those are just going to be the single entries that would have been the entries in the matrix xc cross and xc plus. So actually, I think that's what's going to work. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah, sorry. It's because of these picking out the particular component that I don't have to sum over there, and I'm going to get the components that I want instead of an actual tensor. Yeah. It should be what?
Sum over L.
Yeah, the L's, so the L's are sum. That's right. But the IJs are the components. Yeah. Probably would have been better if I'd written this squared. So that guy's automatic. That would have been a better notation. Okay, so now I think if we plug in this expansion for each of those guys, we're going to pick out just the components that we want and have two equations for H for the two combinations, which now I forgot what I've labeled them at this point, gamma plus ones. Okay, so then we do the usual thing, and we're going to get two versions of gamma hat, let me call it plus, gamma hat plus, which is going to be the same as the gamma hat minus gamma hat minus. And basically, all of these have the same spectrum, h squared over 2k cubed. And then we have to undo this. So for the unhatted versions, we're going to get h squared over a Planck squared. There's a 1 over 2k cubed, and there's going to be a 4 upstairs. Is that right? From this 2? So that's going to give us basically a 2 over k cubed. Yep. So then the only thing that's left to do is to say that when we actually look at how much power is in the tensor modes, these guys add up. So from the point of view of the CMB, there's not a distinction between these two, and they just want, usually just ask for the total power. In tensors. And once you do that, and I think there's a factor of 2 actually from contracting these two guys, you end up with something that goes like P, let's call it PT for total tensor power. OK. And so remember, also, I'm going to the dimensionless thing here. So I'm getting rid of the k cubed, and there's a 2 pi squared that comes in. Once we do that, we're going to have h squared over m Planck squared pi squared. And the correct factor of 2 is actually that one, I think. So the thing that WMAP actually constrains is actually the ratio of power in tensors over scalars, which they call R. And the exact definition of this thing has changed over time. So you sometimes see it with very different coefficients that had to do with, I think they were trying to have some matching at some particular mode of the CMB, something like that. But the current definition that WMAP uses is the ratio of the quantities as we have them here. And you can see that all that happens is the h squareds and m Planck squareds cancel, the pi squareds cancel. We had, I guess it got erased, we had an 8 in the denominator for the scalar part, and we had an epsilon. So this thing just becomes 16 epsilon. So this is the number that's the one to keep in your mind, actually, because that's the thing you know if you know the slow roll parameters, and that's the thing that's actually constrained by observation. Yeah. So basically, each of them individually has this combination here, but PT has to be the total power in tensor modes. So it's the sum of those two guys, basically. There's a factor of 2 that I dropped, but I think it's probably from contracting these or something. So yeah. So basically, it's just that these combinations have this nice helicity transformation. So they have a definition in terms of a definite helicity or a definite polarization. And so you write that in terms of the factors that I get. I should have gotten essentially the same answer, but those are the combinations that are just nicer. So because of the way they transform. So you're right that this stuff doesn't much matter for what we did. I mean, after all, we had the power spectrum 6 days ago by just making that choice of the matrix. But it's just. Yeah, when you go to plug in the most general form, it's usually written in terms of those combinations because they transform nicely. But the only thing that matters for the purposes of keeping things in your mind about what you use to constrain inflation is that, first of all, there's no epsilon here. That's the key feature. So basically, this only, if you measure this, you're really measuring H. And the ratio is some relatively small number. So the constraint on this thing right now is something like depending on which data set combination you look at. I think it's something of order 0.2. Okay. Okay, so I want to just clear up a couple of things that, yeah.
Are you sure that there is no sum in the first one?
Yeah, not in that one. So I don't think it makes sense to take a sum there, because I want to set each gamma ij equal to that thing.
Am I right to say that gamma is symmetric on ij?
That's right, it is symmetric. That which gamma is identically zero? What I've written there?
That implies that gamma is identically zero for all its components. If gamma is symmetric, and for each mode, gamma is symmetric. But the right hand side will be anti-symmetric, and the left hand side will be symmetric. Gamma, each component of gamma will be minus zero.
You're saying if it's not a sum? So the epsilons are supposed to be picking out for me those combinations. And I think the fact that I haven't, so the epsilons are some matrices, right? And they have entries, let's see. So for example, epsilon ij should itself be something like it's probably something like this in the if k is in the z direction. So it must pick out from either component. Yeah. I'm not sure that that's exactly the right expression for epsilon, but it's something like that. Okay, good. Anything else? Okay. So let me just, okay. Go back to a couple of things that we mentioned before. Sorry, do you have another question? Yeah, so basically I'm just taking out this normalization factor, which I got because going back to how we'd written the action here, I needed to absorb the M Planck, and there's an extra 1 over 4 compared to the usual 1 half gamma dot squared, and so that gives me an extra half in each of these. Does that make sense?
So where's the definition of gamma minus?
So gamma minus has a similar normalization, right? The normalization factor is the same for everybody.
What is gamma minus itself?
So it's this combination of the plus and cross components.
With the minus sign.
Yeah, with the minus sign. Yeah, thanks.
So gamma ij is the matrix now for every ij?
So it is. It's a matrix. It's that matrix over there, essentially. There's one matrix, and there's one epsilon ij. There's two epsilon ij's, I guess, which basically pick out for me. So when I wrote a particular choice for gamma in components, that was one that worked. Yeah. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I mean, it's still, there's a matrix multiplication, so it's still a matrix, but yeah. But it's not one for each. Okay, so one thing I wanted to go back to is we said a long time ago that we could check that our decomposition into the background and the perturbations was actually good. So let me just show you what that means. So we want to check that perturbations are small. In other words, that we don't have a big back reaction from the fluctuations on the background. And the way we do that is we want to evaluate the stress energy tensor for fluctuations. Let's look at the 0,0 component. And we want to make sure that whatever is sitting in here, it's small compared to the energy of the background. Because after all, this is what was giving us, this thing was essentially V of phi, right? So the 0,0 component is the energy density, and that's basically the potential to assign. And we said that this was basically what was generating 3h squared and Planck squared. And if it wasn't dominating, you know, in the sense that if the potential energy wasn't dominating, we didn't have inflation. So we want to check that the energy that we have here isn't going to mess that up. So we worked out a couple days ago the first order term for the perturbation delta T00, but that was just first order and delta phi. When I take expectation value, the only thing that's going to matter are the quadratic pieces. First order terms are going to cancel. So you need to go to the next order in that expansion, but it's just what you would expect, right? The full expression here is the potential energy and the kinetic energy. So you need to expand both of those things to second order in the fluctuations, basically. And what you find is, so before we had expanded to first order, and we had things like phi 0 dot, delta phi dot from the kinetic term, and we had b comma phi, delta phi, things like that. But each of these quantities is set so that their mean is 0, their average is 0. So expectation value of these first order things vanishes. And what we need is the next order term, so that's going to be things like delta phi dot squared over 2 and b with two derivatives. Delta phi squared. There should be, a half there, too. And we want to take expectation value of that thing and compare it to this, which is essentially just v of phi on the background. Okay? Forget about this. So again, the way I can estimate these quantities is to replace, sorry, and there's also a gradient piece, right? So there's also an a squared di phi squared term. So there's a kinetic energy, a gradient energy, which goes along with that, and a potential energy. So I want to use the same trick that I can essentially approximate d by dt by h. That's the scale in the problem. That's the scale over which things are freezing out of the horizon and essentially have time to back react on the whole system. And I can similarly consider d by dx. Now this is the physical coordinate, and there's a factor of scale factor in front of it. Sorry, this is the comoving coordinate, and there's a scale factor in the metric. So to get the physical coordinate, I need a factor of a. These are always minus here. And it's ah. Okay. So I can roughly evaluate the order of magnitude of this thing by using those conditions, and what I find is h squared delta phi squared, and I get a factor of 2 because these things basically add up, expectation value, and then I get this term, which is going to be smaller, right? So basically this is related to a slow roll parameter. The eta parameter, if you like, is v prime prime over v, and v is h squared and Planck squared. So this is small compared to this term, so let's just keep this term. And on the bottom, I've got h squared and Planck squared. So any particular mode, I know what this is. I know, again, that it's of order h squared. So this thing is of order h to the 4 over h squared and Planck squared. And so what it says is that if I want the energy in perturbations to be small, I want h over m Planck to be less than 1. Okay, and that seems like a very reasonable condition anyway. Otherwise, if we have too much gradient energy, for example, you might think inflation could end, something like that. So essentially, since this condition is very sensible from us even writing down this theory, right? We don't want to write down a theory at energy scales greater than m Planck, you're never going to violate this for the most part, and so you're always safe in slow roll inflation. Yeah, I'm always being very sloppy. So I always mean that this is the k piece, and I'm just looking at the. Yeah, these are all. Whenever the k appears here, I'm always shorthanding it for the. This is kk. And you know, really, it comes multiplied with a delta function and 2 pi cubed and all that stuff. But I just want to keep track of the magnitude. So. Okay, so that's a reasonableness condition. Okay, the other thing I wanted to do, since I think a lot of people have been asking, is I wanted to say what happens when we don't just care about the k-space part.
So not the power spectrum, but the correlation function. So we keep writing on the board this expression. And what it came from, let me use k dot r. So r is going to be the difference between x and y. And essentially it came from looking at the square of the mode functions. And we were calling this thing the power spectrum. And we said that it had dimensions such that this thing, d3k, over 2k cubed. And if we used symmetry to simplify this, this was an integral dk over k, something like sine kr over kr. And the piece that left over was the dimensionless thing. So this is, if I'm doing, I'm just putting a random field phi here, so let me just call this p phi. And we said this is essentially constant. And if that's true, this looks like a terrible integral, right? Essentially, in the limit where this goes to 1, this looks like it's logarithmically divergent, so it has a problem in the UV and it has a problem in the IR. And this thing is supposed to be related to observations, so what are we supposed to do? So there are basically two ways to discuss this issue. One is the theoretical question part, and one is the observational part. So let's first talk about the theoretical assumptions that went into making this statement. Okay, so first, if I evaluate this integral from 0 to infinity, then I'm claiming that this is the mode function for every single mode ever. Making that assumption, we got the solution for the mode function by assuming we had massless field in de Sitter space, right? Exact de Sitter space. So making the assumption that this is the correct integral from 0 to infinity is in a way equivalent to saying that we have eternal inflation. We have exact de Sitter space for all time. So this integral, so let me say in, let me just make this form, dk over k. Okay, so that's not true, right? It's at least that's an interesting question to ask, but that's not the question of observational interest. So you can certainly ask, if I want to imagine that I had eternal de Sitter space, is that a consistent system to think about? But that's not the question of observational interest. In other words, it's not the world we see. Because at a minimum, inflation ends. And basically what that means is that at some point, we always talk about this as being the power spectrum. This is outside the horizon also, right? So we evaluated this once things have stopped fluctuating, basically. There is a point at which inflation ends, and there's a mode that corresponds to freezing out at that point. Let's call it kn, which is equal to A, H is nearly constant, but A evaluated at eta end, at the time when inflation ends. So any modes that are smaller than this, right? So smaller in the sense of length, so they're larger K, don't matter. Essentially, they don't have that solution. So that gives us a cutoff that k, k is less than k end, right? I go to smaller scales, which is larger k. Also, chances are good inflation began.
It's not necessarily true, but it could well be true. And for all we know, after all, inflation only had to last, 55 e-folds, no more at all, to explain things. So if that's true, then we have the opposite statement. Basically, the solution we found is only valid for k greater than some k initial, which is related to h a initial. So this is a lot fuzzier because we don't know how exactly, how do we start inflation? We had some radiation era, then we had some radiation, some inflationary era. How do we patch them together? It's not particularly clear, and it's hard to actually make this statement precise. But probably there is some way that you make this transition, at least intuitively, you expect that this isn't the answer for all k. Okay? The other thing is, this is a exactly free, exactly massless field, right? This is the answer for a free, massless field. This is never true. All fields are interacting gravitationally, so it's never exactly a free field. And it's rarely true that this is, and maybe never true, that this is an exact statement, that it's massless. As soon as you have interactions, you can get terms basically that generate things that look like effective masses. And then that's no longer true. And we saw that for a massive field, that integral became integral dk over k, that same p of pi, but then there was a term here that went like minus k eta to the delta, where delta was m squared over h squared, which is greater than 0. So as soon as you have a mass, the IR problem here is fixed. Right? This now is better behaved in the k goes to 0 limit than it was before. And then this problem is solved for you observationally. But that's not all. There's more. So those statements were related to if we want to make a good theoretical model of inflation as we think it happened. The other part of this is that observationally, we have essentially a complementary set of issues, right? One is that we can only see k as large as our current horizon, right? So k greater than ah today, and usually the knot on ah means ah today. Okay, so basically we're stuck with having to measure a background and set where we think zero modes are of things based on the scale of our horizon today. So what that means is, for example, there could be a really large scale curvature fluctuation. And if our universe is this scale and sits on top of this, so that we see fluctuations on top of that, sort of the large scale zero could be here. But our local zero is somewhere here. And even though it's true that inflation inflates away curvature, again, we only know that it was necessary to have 50 e-folds, right? We know curvature is small, but we don't know exactly what its value is from a global measurement. We just know that it's small. So in practice then, so what this means is that we need to measure zero to then get curvature fluctuations with the mean set at zero. So we're talking about fluctuations above and below some scale. And what that does is it gets rid of that any effect from any lower scale that might actually be popping in that integral, in the IR. Because what it says is that suppose, I don't know what else to call it besides C, suppose big curvature, that's what we measure at each point, right? And that's some background value as defined on a larger scale. So that's a background value as defined on some scale. Let's call it L, where that scale is greater than H inverse, so it's outside of our horizon. And it's plus the fluctuation that we see, zeta. So because we don't know this, we have to get rid of it. So the best we can do is to measure C at x1, C at x2, and subtract off from that some reference C of x1 compared to C of x3, let's say. Okay? And you can see that when I plug this expression in, and I want this thing to have mean zero, I'm going to get two terms for each of these. Terms that go like expectation value of zeta at the combination of points, and I'm going to get plus the value of this guy minus the value of this guy. So it's going to cancel off. So this goes to zeta x1, zeta x2, minus zeta x1, zeta x3. Let me leave this. So if it was true that when I evaluated this integral, it was from some scale L inverse, this is a decay integral, and I had here, sine kr over kr times some amplitude, p, let's make the dimensionless combination everywhere of kr. So let's make this an integral over dk hat, k hat. So now this is L inverse r, sine k hat over k hat times p. So when I do this integral, I'm going to have p times log of kr, right? Of L inverse r. So r was x1 minus x2 over the scale L. Something like this. Okay, so we're ignoring the UV issue because we're thinking that's taken care of in a different way. So I have some log like this. But when I compare those two terms, those two measurements, they both have a log like this with the same scale L. So that scale L is going to cancel out. So basically, when I look at x1, x2, x1, x3, this is just going to be the magnitude. And I'm still going to have a log, but now all that appears in the log are the distant scales that I'm looking at. Right? The L's canceled. Yeah. Sorry, sure. The start. Yeah, sorry. So basically, I can only do local measurements, and I can only do local measurements within the horizon, right? And do some statistics on those. Since I can't see outside the horizon, I don't know where to define as the zero of curvature. I mean, we can make global measurements about the total evolution of the universe, and we can put bounds on how curved it can be compared to how much matter there is, compared to how much radiation there is, because we measure all those things. But all we know is that curvature is small. It doesn't have to be zero. And if inflation lasted slightly longer than this, there could have been some curvature fluctuation on the background, right, that's basically as large as our horizon, compared to some other zero that's defined by some other, fancy observer who can see everything. And we don't know that. So the best we can do is to define a local zero. And the only way we can define a local zero is to compare sets of measurements like this. So because we always want to define fluctuations about a mean, we have to decide what the mean is. We have to measure that at the same time. And so this mean, of course, is a mean. It doesn't have to be a mean on infinitely large scales. It just has to be a mean on scales somewhat larger than our horizon. So that's why I'm just saying it's a mean on some scale L of order of the horizon. Does that make sense? It doesn't have to be true at all scales, because it just has to be somewhat more locally true than it is for what we can see. It's true on the scale of our current horizon rather than on the scale within our current horizon. Does that make sense? Kind of. So what we're doing is we're just saying we want to define the fluctuation as being a fluctuation around whatever zero we measure in our background. And the only way to get rid of the zero is basically to subtract it off by comparing sets of measurements. It's different for things like density. Density, you can say what a local zero is, right? Because all you need to do is look at the matter enclosed by a sphere. But in that case, it's different because you actually get a factor of k squared from the Poisson equation, and you don't have this IR issue. So for things where you can do a local measurement with a definite zero, you don't have this problem, and they also don't diverge in the IR. So for the ones where you do have the problem, this is the answer. So whatever the scale is, I guess the point is, as long as this is a good definition of the perturbation, that scale cancels out of the answer for any measurement, and so it doesn't matter. So the but I should say that I'm still cheating a little bit because this cancellation is only true at lowest order. So that'll just give you something to worry about at night. And then the counterpart of the second statement that we had theoretically is that, of course, no measurement can see infinite, can see, you know, arbitrarily small distances. So no measuring device small scales. So there's, again, some limit that we only see k less than some k star. And this depends on what the experiment is that we're doing. But in practice, what people do then is whether you're looking at the CMB and you have to, you know, some finite pixel size, or you're looking at the structure of dark matter and you only care about things on the scale of, you know, clusters of 10 to the 18, 10 to the 14 solar masses, something like that, there's some sense in which you don't care or you don't need information about those smaller scale things, right? So there's something that you do, which is, I'm sure, done in many fields besides physics. I'm sure we're not the masters of this technique, which is called smoothing. And basically what you do is you introduce into this integral a window function I think my handwriting is degrading as the day goes by. Window function. That's going to weight information from different scales such that you smooth out nicely as k goes to infinity. So for example, this thing might just be a Gaussian, e to the minus k squared r squared. And what you define from this is your variance, or your two-point function, smoothed on some scale r. R is what appears here, and basically you can see that this thing gets really tiny for k much greater than r. So when this thing becomes large, or inverse, sorry. Okay. So in practice, there's always something either that's forced on you, you know, from your instrument or whatever, that comes in as a smoothing function here and cuts this off. So for observations, you don't worry about either one. And from a theoretical point of view, at least for something that's not exact a sitter, for an exactly massive field, you also don't have to worry. But how you exactly correct the problem is interesting by itself. Okay? Does that make sense? Yeah.
Why do we introduce the window function?
Yeah. So basically, okay, this is a claim, right? No measurement sees arbitrarily small distance scales. But in practice, what you might have is some beam of your telescope. Now I'm going to get into experimental land, or I don't know what I'm talking about, but you're going to have some aperture size, or you're going to have some limit on how well you can measure mass or something like that, which is going to set your scale of the smallest thing you can resolve. Right? That's right. So you have to make sure that you've incorporated all the scales that you can actually resolve and that you're interested in. And sort of built into this is the assumption that there's no true infinity in whatever it is that you're smoothing over, right? But there shouldn't be if it's physical. So you're right that the answer is going to depend on what you choose for r. And so, for example, to give you one example, if you're looking at objects of a different mass size, then the scale in which you want to smooth is related to the mass of that object, which by volume is related to the radius. Right, because if you have some collapsed clump of structure, you don't resolve the details of what's going on inside there. You just resolve that you have a collapsed clump of matter of mass m, which is of size r. So in some ways, there's extreme, and sometimes it's just the physical system that gives you a very physical reason for smoothing over some structure. Other times, it's the true limitation of the instrument, and you have to smooth over that. So you're right. It certainly depends on scale, and it's up to you to make sure you choose the scale so that it contains all the relevant information. And you can check that, of course, by varying it slightly in one direction or the other. And if you increase it and nothing changes, then that's good. Okay. The other thing, I guess I should just mention, that's nice about this is that as you let, basically, since this is the variance smoothed on a scale, as you let this thing go to the horizon size, you can always check that this quantity should go to zero, right? Because once we get out to horizon size, that's what we've defined as the zero by that argument there. So this thing goes to zero as r goes to infinity, basically, because you want to go back to the zero. There's no fluctuation. If I smooth over the whole universe, then that's sort of the definition of what the zero mode is in some sense. Okay. So tomorrow what we're going to do is summarize a few of the qualitative things that we've learned about how we actually can test inflation. So a lot of what we've done is very nice. We've done these calculations. But there are several things that matter very much to whether we know if inflation is the right theory or not. And they matter very much to observationalists. And a huge part of that is non-Gaussianity, which is basically statistics beyond the power spectrum. So I'm going to talk about those types of observations and what they look like from the theoretical side a little bit tomorrow.